The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week, with my global roster of guests, I'll be talking about emerging and frontier markets, investing in them, and trying to clear up some of the confusion that may surround these different markets. I spent most of my professional career analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of clients' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and ones that may be less promising. By emerging markets, of course, we mean the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, but also we include such markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, Colombia, and the Czech Republic. Today, I'll be looking into two Colombian stocks that may have taken unfair hits in the market by overreaction to their earnings recently. We'll also be examining some reasons why they might recover. Colombia is generally ranked as an emerging markets, but it's also included in the Frontier Emerging Markets Index, making it what's known as a crossover market, meaning it's on the cusp in between frontier and emerging market status. By frontier markets, we mean those generally less developed emerging markets like Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, Slovakia, and Botswana. Today, we'll be looking at the rebirth of Rwanda and some Argentinian stocks that may perform well in spite of the major economic issues which are overhanging the Argentinian economy. And we'll look into the actual investment-making decision process for investors with another contributor to our book, Investing in Frontier Markets. Our first guest is going to help us sort out some of the more glaring misconceptions about frontier markets, including defining what they are. These misconceptions can help cost investors money, not necessarily in terms of losses, but in terms of opportunity cost. The unfamiliarity with frontier markets makes people unwilling to invest there when their prospects may actually be very attractive. I have Daniel Broby on the line from the Silk Invest Funds office in Dubai. Daniel is the Chief Investment Officer Alternatives at Silk Invest. Before that was head of asset management and a director at the Renaissance Africa Fund. And before that held positions at Bank Invest and Morgan Stanley Quilter Capital Markets. Welcome to the program, Daniel. We've spoken to a number of your Silk Invest colleagues previously, and it's great to have you on as well.
Thanks, Gavin.
So can we start off by actually defining what does Silk Invest regard as frontier markets? Because obviously there are a fair number of indexes out there and some confusion about what exactly is a frontier market.
Sure. Well, I think you hit it on the nail when you were discussing it earlier. Effectively, a frontier market is off-benchmark emerging markets. So it's the next generation. And they're not included in the traditional benchmarks for a reason, which is that they're either illiquid or there are market access issues, either due to restrictions on things like foreign ownership or possibly even access problems because of custody and or the stage of development of the market.
So, in essence, as you say, that they're not included in the index. And it's not merely because they may be less developed. There may actually be restrictions on foreign investment in that market, as, for example, Saudi Arabia. But also, there are one or two frontier markets like, say, Argentina, which used to be developed markets and then sort of slipped down. Is there an important distinction to be made between countries like that and, say, Venezuela and the next generation of emerging markets that most of the frontier markets represent?
Sure. Yeah. Sadly, I would classify Argentina as a submerging market.
And
yes. The trouble with that is that it's going the wrong way with regards to its institutions, its policy decisions, and what it's doing on the macroeconomic front. So it's not a safe place for investors. The rest of frontier markets, or at least those frontier markets that we're investing in, are those that are effectively on the cusp of becoming emerging markets, are on the S-curve of development, and are effectively going to become emerging markets because of their growth trajectory.
Yeah. And so, obviously, as with any developing market, there are issues. You mentioned things like, for example, custody, and obviously these are relatively small and illiquid markets. So while there's obviously a good macro story behind it, are there some specific sort of things that the faster developing frontier markets are doing correctly? Are there some major misconceptions that people have about specific regions, for example, that might be dissuading them from investing?
First let's just look at how big these places are in terms of the general scheme of things. We're talking about markets that cover 25% of the world's population. Admittedly, yep. That's the poorest part of the world's population. But that said, in GDP terms, they may be hitting under their weight, but there are still investors delivering consumer goods to these markets. And there are public markets that can be accessed as well as private markets can be accessed. So the fact that these are, as you quite rightly pointed out, illiquid markets doesn't preclude investment. And in fact, the misperceptions that you mentioned mean that the risk-reward ratio is mispriced in investment terms, thereby meaning you get effectively more return for the incremental risks that you take on board into your portfolio.
Right. And so as you mentioned, there are some sort of specific operational logistical issues like liquidity and custody. Are we seeing some improvements in that area? Are there major new sort of equity issues, or is there a frontier bond market, for example? I know there have been some issues by some of these countries in the last year or so, taking advantage of the exceptionally low spreads between these developing markets and the major developed markets.
Sure. Well, not only is there new issuance in terms of IPOs on a regular basis now, but actually we've even got new stock markets springing up. So, for example, Rwanda has a stock market that just didn't exist 2 years ago and has new companies listing on that. We have bond issuance from countries that have never issued before, like, for example, Mozambique. So quite clearly there's a lot happening, and obviously as the world globalizes and as technology rolls out to places that previously didn't have it, we're seeing a game changer in terms of the speed of which these markets are developing their capital markets.
So the overall size of frontier markets as a sort of either in absolute terms or as a percentage of the total global stock market capitalization is still fairly small, though, despite all these positive developments.
Sure, yeah. I mean, depending on how you define it, we're still talking about sort of between 2 and 4% of global market capitalization, a lot of that which is sort of tightly held by locals and so forth. But, you know, that's still a large amount of mm-hmm. effectively equity and or bond issuance that's out there. So the reasons often given that it's too small a universe to go into are often because people really don't appreciate that the large number of markets like this that there are out there and the large number of securities that are issued on those markets.
Right. And as you mentioned, it's 25% of the world population. Somewhere, 11, 12% of world GDP, if you're using a purchasing power parity basis, would that be correct?
Sure, yeah. I mean, again, it depends how you define it, because as you said, there are crossover markets, which some people define, some people don't, and there are some markets, for example, as you pointed out, the largest sort of frontier market in terms of market capitalization. Some people just can't invest in Saudi Arabia because that market actually totally precludes foreign investment, although funds like ours get access to it through total return swaps and derivative instruments.
Right. So, as you said, the risk-reward, though, is favorable because the price that you're paying for access to this rapid economic growth, the improvements in governance, the introduction of things like stock markets, is still fairly cheap. Do Silk Invest have a sort of price earnings or dividend yield number for the universe that you look at in terms of how much people are paying to get in?
It's easier to show mispricing in the bond market, so let me just point out that the bond yields are at a 230 to 250 basis point pickup to emerging market bond yields, which are already picking up yield as against what the U.S. Treasury is trading at. So you can immediately see from that, for the same credit quality that people are paying effectively a lot less to capture the return opportunity that they would elsewhere.
Right. And so to sort of finish up the this extremely interesting sort of overview of the frontier markets, would it be reasonable to suggest, as I think you mentioned a little earlier, that many investors are simply unfamiliar with this asset class, don't realize how rapidly it's growing, how large it's been getting, and that that's one of the major reasons, this unfamiliarity is one of the major reasons why they are mispriced and why people haven't really looked at them yet?
Sure. And also the fact that asset allocation committees tend to be committees, therefore have large numbers of people on them, and find that investing in places where you normally read about them in the news, and normally that news flow isn't positive, you tend to find that because of that, the as I said, the local investors are the ones who are setting the price.
So to summarize, it would be fair to say that in essence, frontier markets are where emerging markets were, what, a dozen, 15 years ago, and
Yeah, 20 years ago.
And therefore, while it's obviously, it's very difficult to make a forecast, especially about the future, as I think Yogi Berra said, it would be reasonable to anticipate they, at least on the economic side, are going to enjoy some of the same growth we've seen over the last 20 years.
That's certainly our thesis, and we're putting our money where our mouth is on that one, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much indeed, Daniel. Do appreciate you taking the time, and I trust we'll have the opportunity of speaking to you or maybe one of your colleagues from Silk Invest in the not-too-distant future.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Daniel. Cheers.
Thank you. Thanks to Daniel Brobey, Chief Investment Officer Alternatives at Silk Invest, from the company's office in Dubai. In this segment, we were covering some of the misconceptions that investors had about frontier markets and the funds that invest there. Now, in the next segment, we're going to be talking about how you would go about investing in frontier markets. And we, in our book, Investing in Frontier Markets, we actually suggest that it's sensible to do this with the help of an advisor, because given the lack of familiarity and volatility in these markets, it's extremely important to have a relationship where you have somebody to guide you through this process. So we're going to be looking about how concerns and hesitations about investing in frontier markets, and to a certain extent, emerging markets, can get ironed out between advisor and client. And we'll be talking to someone who's worked with a lot of advisors about how they deal with issues like this, who'll be on the line to us from Calgary. Please stay with me for that.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
the boardroom to you. Voice America Business Network.
Listen for exclusive clips from Oprah's upcoming Super Soul Sunday series on Authentic Living with Andrea Matthews every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America 7th Wave channel. Then be sure to watch Oprah's Super Soul Sunday on OWN Network TV at 11 a.m., 10 Central every Sunday.
We hear it and read about it every day in the news.
America is heading over a fiscal cliff. Home prices are still receding and unemployment growing.
How can you preserve and increase your wealth in this kind of economy? Tune in to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with host Jay Taylor. Jay will explain the decline of our monetary system and the economy and will give you winning investment ideas and the tools to protect and increase your wealth.
Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor can be heard Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
The Mayan calendar tells us that we will be entering into a 260-day opportunity for us to engage in conscious co-creation with Great Spirit. How will we prepare ourselves for this exciting and unprecedented time in Earth's history? Peter Tung has dedicated over 20 years of his life's work to exploring that which is beyond understanding. Peter will help increase your awareness and education on this enlightening transformation in consciousness. Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation airs live Wednesdays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on 7th Wave Network.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. In the previous editions of this program and in both of the books we have written on frontier markets, we talk about the issues involved in these markets and the factors that we hope you'll take into consideration when making your investment decisions. What we also suggest, as I mentioned before the break, is that emerging particular frontier market investing decisions not necessarily suited to do-it-yourself investing. You can certainly try to do it yourself if that's your choice and you're an experienced investor. But we'd argue that, especially given the lack of familiarity most investors have with frontier markets in particular, you should make your decisions after closely consulting your financial advisor. To go further with that, I have Jim Ruta on the line from Calgary, Alberta, where he's partway through a speaking tour. He's a financial industry consultant and advisor coach and was a major contributor to our book, Investing in Frontier Markets. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Thank you, Grant. Yeah, Gavin, good to be here.
Glad to have you here, because this is an important issue. I mean, we know in principle there's no particular harm in a knowledgeable and experienced investor going the do-it-yourself route when investing in North America or Europe, familiar areas where you know the companies and you've had many years' experience in those markets. Is it fair to say it's an entirely different situation when you're investing in unfamiliar markets like the frontier markets?
Well, you know, when you just think about the word frontier, and if you sort of look that up, and because even on a practical level, you know, frontier means the limit of knowledge or the outer limit of a field of endeavor, that kind of thing. You know, I think that's important. You know, and I was walking up the jetway yesterday here in Calgary and read a little ad from a very prominent worldwide bank who says that, you know, in the future, investors will have to be explorers. You know, and I think when you put it that way and you realize that frontier markets are at the edge of our knowledge, at the edge of our understanding in most cases, well, then it would be silly. It could be silly, really, to do that without the help of a guide, an experienced guide, absolutely. So I think if you're going to be exploring, it really makes sense to have somebody there who knows the territory, knows where you're going, just to avoid the pitfalls, because there's some things that are dramatically more obvious than others if you've been there before. But if you haven't, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. And that's why I think advisors make a great deal of sense all the time, really, because not everybody has the same degree of familiarity. But if you find the right advisor who has that familiarity, well, then you're going to be able to, you know, do your exploring into frontier and emerging markets a lot more easily, and I think a lot more safely.
So a very good and important point to make there, Jim. I think also when you actually are talking to an advisor's talking to a client, A, the client needs to be open about their total financial situation, obviously, but also that part of the conversation which you always need to have with the client about their tolerance for risk, how comfortable they are with volatility, is going to be reinforced in spades when you're looking at markets like the frontier markets, where they are illiquid and inefficient and pretty volatile. Would that be a correct statement?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think this is where you really have to do it. Like I said, even after the 2008-2009 recession, you know, that, well, the days of really thinking you could sort of dump your portfolio and just pray that it worked out, I think those were long gone. And that's really always been true in complicated markets or in difficult investing situations, which this is really clearly what this is, as in, you know, even listening to your last guest, you can tell this is not just the simplest of things. So you really do need help. If you want, you know, things like suitable recommendations, and you want to have confidence in your advisors, well, that'll, one, I think that takes some time. I don't think you want to do this, just rush into this sort of thing. And we need lots of discussions. We need discussions about the risk loss, not just risk reward. I think a lot of us just talk about risk reward and say, well, you know, the greater the risk, the greater the reward. But of course, the greater the risk, the greater the potential loss of everything. And that can really affect a lot of people. I really think that the Great Recession reset the advisor-client relationship. I think it proved also, certainly from the reaction I heard from many advisors, from the reaction of their clients, that many of us are poor judges of our own risk tolerance. Mm-hmm. I think advisors, you know, really need to have the hard discussions with clients to get at the real truth. Not the bravado truth. I think some clients could be impressed by the whole idea, the mystery and the excitement of an emerging market, and, you know, and we're talking to Dubai and we're talking about, you know, these interesting marketplaces. Well, let's be honest. I mean, we want to do this right. We don't invest for, you know, as a charitable event, and it shouldn't be just a lottery. So, you know, we really want, I think advisors really need to, and if clients are looking at this, and as an investor, you want to say, like, does my advisor really know me well enough? Do they know enough that they can really make a suitable recommendation for me, not just for the product, but is there a match between me and the product and the security or the whatever that issue is in that particular marketplace? Because one of the real jobs that advisors have is to prevent investors from behaving badly and from making, you know, just silly mistakes. And I think that's the most galling part of it. You know, Gavin, if you go through this and you make, you know, oh, man, I made a rookie mistake. A good advisor should be able to minimize at least the number of rookie mistakes that are made. And, you know, I've got a friend in Connecticut, a very top advisor, her KYC on this in terms of that discussion, knowing her client, is so in-depth that she really does know and really can help that advisor make the right decision.
So, and you'd really need to have that degree of knowledge and or confidence in your reading of the client to be able to say what proportion of a client's portfolio should be invested into the more volatile, riskier is a word we're cautious about using, because if you're actually getting paid for taking that risk, that's fair enough, as our previous discussion was dealing with. But effectively, the advisor really does have to have a good grasp of what the client's risk tolerance is when you're talking especially about volatile areas like emerging and frontier markets investing.
Certainly. Look, proportion of portfolio is a tolerance of risk matter. I mean, I think, at least, to a large degree. So, you know, so proportion of portfolio, how much are you prepared to put up? You know, you're right. You know, risk is, you know, if you're being paid for it, you know what you're doing. I think that's all part of that. Do we know? And I think having an investor who understands the risk, and then when we match that risk with their tolerance level, I think this can be a very useful thing. But the deeper your knowledge of the investor's tolerance, I think the greater proportion you can direct into an investment opportunity or not. But you have to have deep knowledge here if you want to be able to be successful. I think as an advisor, you've got to do that properly. And as an investor, you want to make sure that you have had the tough discussion. You have had hard questions asked of you, because the time to have those questions is before you get into trouble, not after.
Absolutely.
Let's do this. Let's get this out of the way now. And so we know what to do. And that's really, it's a triage question. It's a real issue with respect to any time you're into a difficult situation. Let's know what our egress approach is and how we're doing this and how we're going to react. That's the most important thing.
No, I mean, that's an absolutely vital point, and I think you're right. It's not saying what percentage or what proportion. It's what is the client's tolerance risks. Because to finish up here, as our previous discussion was covering, the only time most people in the developed world are going to see these frontier markets is when there's some bad news on the evening newscast or on the internet news services, whether it's natural disasters or political coups or inflation or hyperinflation. How does an advisor ensure the client is not too frightened or too put off to go into areas where, as we believe on this program, there are some very attractive long-term investment opportunities so that the client can reap the benefits while at the same time still being able to sleep at night?
Yeah, when you say sleep at night, you don't mean like sleep like a baby, three or four times at night. Yeah, exactly. Again, this is really an advisor. You have to trust your advisor, and your advisor has to trust his or her knowledge of that client. Because you see, as you're saying, even the most dangerous territory that you're exploring can have some extraordinary views and some extraordinary rewards when you're exploring in a scary, mysterious sort of place. But if you have the right advisor walking you through that, you see, you can go through all kinds of what would look to be danger. And you're right, you only hear about it when there's a crisis in the marketplace, whether it's a geopolitical issue of some description, or it's,
natural disaster or whatever. Yep.
Natural disasters, exactly, that sort of thing. So, yeah, absolutely. You don't want to do anything except you want to make sure the advisor can sleep at night, and that means knowledge of that client. It goes down to that knowledge. It goes down to a good relationship with a good advisor who can guide you effectively so you know that he knows or she knows what's going on, and then you and the advisor knows that you understand the deal. You got the deal. Like, that's really the point. What is the deal you make with your investor before the deal is made elsewhere?
And I think those are very, very important points. It's almost when people start saying, how much should you invest, or what's a reasonable upside, or whatever, you say, no, I mean, where are you coming from? What's your understanding of risk, your tolerance of risk? And as you say, the advisor has to have a very good handle on that before being able to make sensible recommendations. So that's been extremely useful, Jim, and we really do appreciate that input and all the input you also gave us on the book, Investing in Frontier Markets, and very good luck with the rest of your speaking tour.
Thank you very much, Gavin. I appreciate it. All the best in London.
Thanks so much. Thanks to Jim Reuter for taking the time out from his speaking tour in Calgary and for his contribution to our book, Investing in Frontier Markets. You can see more of what Jim has to say and what we had to say as well about the role of the advisor and why it's important to have some guidance when investing in frontier markets by checking some of the book selling sites such as Amazon.com and Wiley's own website, the publisher. When I come back from the break, I'll be heading to Medellin, Colombia for a look at a couple of stocks that were hit maybe unfairly in the last week or so, and ask our guests whether now is a buying opportunity. Please stay with me for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Colombia is generally ranked as an emerging market and is included in the MSCI Emerging Markets Index, but a number of investors consider it a crossover market, which means it's on the cusp of frontier emerging market status, and in fact, it's one of the five emerging economies in the MSCI Frontier Emerging Markets Index, along with Peru, Morocco, Egypt, and the Philippines. Energy has always been a big part of the Colombian economy, especially on the listed sector in the stock market. Pacific Rubiales is a Colombian stock that's listed in a developed market, Canada, but obviously it's primarily an oil and gas company based in Colombia. Ecopetrol is the largest oil and gas company in Colombia, has ADRs in New York. Both were hit fairly badly in the market after results in one case and comments from the CEO in the other. To talk about this, we've got Rupert Stebbings, Vice President of Equities and Research at Valores Bank Colombia in Medellin, Colombia, to talk about it. Welcome back to the program, Rupert.
Good to be here. Good morning, Gavin.
Morning. Last week, Pacific Rubiales released its results, and they appeared pretty decent, but the local coverage of them did not make it appear so. Could you just let us know what's going on, our listeners know what's going on, and whether or not it's a bit of an overreaction?
Yeah, Rubiales had an interesting week top to bottom. On the Monday, they released a license agreement. They've been waiting for an environmental license for the whole of the year. That was released. They got it. That was very good news. And a couple of days later, they reported numbers that were bang in line, basically, in terms of operations and production and long-term reserves that we were expecting. But the net line was hit by various factors, FX, things like that. Unfortunately, whilst I think most of the foreigners were fairly happy with the results, the locals took a look at the net profit line, which they tend to be obsessed with, and the stock just slid away. It was down 6-7%. I think it's down. It's around 15% down from where it was last week. It just it can't get a foothold at this point, and it's one doesn't want to use the cliche buying opportunity, but it's certainly at levels that are more than appetizing at this point.
Because, as you mentioned, revenues were up, almost 30%, and the earnings before all the bad stuff like interest and taxes and depreciation, which tends to be the number that most people who follow this sector look at, were also up, 26-27%. So those are pretty decent numbers on an operating basis, correct?
Everything was in the right direction, and exactly what you'd want from an exploration and an exploration company that's still building towards the future. I mean, but the problem is here, the company is being judged as a mature company, which it isn't. It's still got a fair way to go before it's a huge oil company. It's big enough, but the locals, unfortunately, they look at net profit, and that hits the press here. It's badly reported in the press, whereas most of the foreigners and most of the reports I read said, look, they're in line, the market may not like them too much, but they're fine. Unfortunately, the market, doesn't like them to the extent of 15% so far. So, yeah, very harshly judged.
And I mean, talking of large oil and gas companies, Ecopetrol, which is still primarily state controlled and is the largest oil and gas company in Colombia, if my memory serves me correctly, also had a fairly torrid time in the last few days as well.
Yeah, they had their investor day in New York on Friday, and unfortunately, the CEO, has put his foot in it somewhat. He obviously made mention of an overseas issuance, possibly in 2014. They're looking at the possibility. Now, in the same week that Avianca listed, until the stock collapsed locally, locals didn't like what they heard from the CEO. The stock got sold off. And there's a couple of other factors as well that they didn't like. But the main one was the issuance. This morning, they've actually reported to the local SEC that no, they're not actually going to do an issuance. It's just something they've considered. But the damage is done. The cat is well and truly out of the bag. And I think now they're going to struggle to convince investors that they don't want to issue shares in 2014.
So, again, in terms of the underlying operating performance of both of these stocks, pretty respectable, if not actually quite good. However, whether it was focusing on the net profit line for Pacific Rubiales or the hint of an issuance, a new equity issue at their investor day, the share price of both has been taken behind the woodshed and beaten up pretty badly. And as you say, without wanting to say it's a buying opportunity, on fundamentals, would it would be fair to say this is somewhat overdone?
Oh yeah, totally overdone. I mean, Rubiales, I think the average analyst has a 50% or plus upside from this level. Heineken Petrol actually booked very good numbers top to bottom, surprisingly so, much better than expected. And again, it's hit levels now around that, you know, really people are starting to look at it. And yesterday we saw a tiny bounce at the end of the day, but nothing next to the distance that's come down already.
All right. Rupert, well, thanks very much indeed. It's always good to talk to you because it's good to get that appreciation of the local attitude towards numbers, which maybe the foreign investor says those look pretty respectable. That's not what the locals are looking at. And you being based there in Medellin, are able to give us that input. Hope to speak to you again soon.
Okay. Take care, Gavin.
Thanks. Thanks to Rupert Stebbings at Valores Bank Colombia on the line from Medellin, Colombia, for that look at Pacific Rubiales and Ecopetrol. My next report focuses on a couple of other stocks that are doing well in another South American country, which has had a few issues. And for that, we have our old friend of the program, Rich Schuller, who is one of the original emerging market investors in Latin America with Battery March Financial from 1984 to 1990. We are going further south towards Argentina, which we talked about a couple of times, and the market keeps on running, at least certain stocks within the market, despite a litany of problems. So as Chief Investment Officer at Baybanks and now President of Argyle Investment Consulting and Argyle Trading Systems, Rich is very well equipped to give us thoughts on how you can make money even in markets that don't necessarily look too exciting. Welcome back to the program, Rich.
Thank you, Gavin. It's great to be back. And Argentina is one of my favorite topics, having wandered the streets there back in the late 80s when only the shadow of John Templeton was there.
And indeed, it was a very successful period in the 1990s under Carlos Menem, liberalization, sort of privatization, the currency peg appeared to be working, and it all went horribly wrong a decade or so ago. We've had a little bit of an echo of some of those problems with the Kirchner administration in the last 18 months, 2 years. Yet, as we've discussed previously on the program, some stocks have actually been doing very well. You very correctly picked this out 4 or 5 months ago when we were first talking about it. Would you like to actually focus on a couple of stocks, because we've got about 5 minutes from here to talk about? I think the first of them was Telecom Argentina. Is that right?
That's right. The Telecom Argentina has the classic profile of the largest telecom from cell phone to other communication services, dominates the market in Argentina. And the stock price was forced down by the various political matters that you had mentioned. And it reached, as often happens in the world of emerging markets. And I guess we should point out also that Morgan Stanley Cap International, in its infinite wisdom, downgraded Argentina from an emerging to a frontier market about 4 years ago.
Yeah,
which I think helped to make the low in the prices. So,
yep.
Those of us who like this kind of investing enjoy those kind of events, not at the expense of those folks, but in terms of the opportunity it provides. And the stock had doubled in front of a recent earnings report that was pretty strong. I noticed from a couple of publicly available sources that their earnings results were up 41%. On net income and 24% on consolidated revenue over the same quarter in 2012, which isn't too bad for a company that probably was somewhat ignored by the global community. I should point out also that the when you do an analysis of local investor behavior versus international and global non-currency, non-Argentine currency-based investors, the locals never really sold the stock, whereas the international group did. So it's when stocks double, you worry a little bit that they could be a bit overpriced, but I see from what are reasonably objective sources, a fair value of $42. I've never been a great believer in that. I prefer to look at the participation of the supply-demand and see when the locals begin to think that their own stock is a bit overvalued. But it's a solid holding at this point, and it pays a pretty good dividend as well. And so I that sector is well represented. I think that...
So just to say, that's TEO for its New York ADR, and excellent. So one more stock then, and I think you had a bank which you also liked as well.
Yes, well, you could. The whole sector is sort of a throw a dart and be happy. But Banco Francés is my old favorite because it's one of the largest and deepest banks in Argentina. It's also had a very good run. It's in local currency. The stock is on an all-time high. It's a bit muted on in dollars, but Banco Galicia and Banco Macro kind of will trade with it, and they are all moving together right now.
These are stocks which you are actually getting paid while you wait, quite apart from the very strong stock market performance. Stock ticker for Banco Francés?
The U.S. is BFR, and and the international folks tend to like to buy the shares there. Just quickly, the other sector that is coming in that would normally fill in at this point, the lagging would be paper, cellulosa, in any of the other basic industries that would benefit from a recovery. Holcim, the cement company, and Ternium, the steel company. And if you do that in the U.S. and you get your brokerage report, don't be surprised that you have not bought Texaco because it has Texaco's old symbol of TX.
Okay. All right. Well, Rich, thank you so much. Again, you very correctly identified this is an interesting market, and some of the stocks we were talking about a few months back, as you said, have gone on to double or better and are still looking pretty attractively valued. So thanks very much, and we'll talk about other markets in the not-too-distant future.
All right, Gavin. Always great to be on.
Thanks. Just to finish up, that was Rich Hula, who is the president of Argyle, and talking about the Argentinian companies and proving that even though the underlying economy may not be in great shape, there are always opportunities to make money, but you do need probably to have someone with Rich's experience and skills to guide you through markets like this. As mentioned in the conversation, Argentina was downgraded by MSCI from emerging to frontier market status, in fact, as long ago as 2009, which, given that it had a hyperinflation and military dictatorship in the 1970s, an unsuccessful foreign war in the Falklands in 1982, and what was then the biggest ever international default back in 2001-2002 for somewhere between $85 and $90 billion, it has not been a market where many investors have made any money, certainly in US dollar or hard currency terms. So just something to be aware of when looking at Argentina, but it doesn't mean that there aren't some individual stocks that might not make you money. When I get back for the break, we'll be moving across the South Atlantic to Africa for a report on another country that has also had a fairly disastrous recent past, but seems to be turning the corner and growing rapidly. For that, I'll be going to our correspondent in Lagos, Nigeria, Samuel Okoja. Please stay with me for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. In this segment, we're going to look again at the continent that's often been called the new China by people who are looking at longer-term prospects. Analysts often suggest that Africa is the largest single region where frontier markets will produce fantastic returns. Some of our guests have suggested part of the explanation lies in the fact that some of these formerly war-torn countries have worked to deal with their past tragedies. They have worked to deal with some of the issues of governance, such as corruption, and they've also moved from autocratic rule to various forms of democratic government. Several weeks ago, we were talking to journalist Kimberly S. Johnson about one such country, Sierra Leone. Today, we're going to look at another such country, Rwanda, which is coming to grips with a sad and bloody history and working on the development of its economy. To do that, I have our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, on the line from Lagos, Nigeria, and he has some fairly surprising facts about Rwanda. Welcome back to the program, Samuel.
Thank you so very much, Gavin.
Now, could you sketch out briefly Rwanda, the size of its population, and where its economy is at the moment?
Yes, interestingly, Rwanda has a population of 11 million, one of the lowest in East Africa. However, because of the conducive business climate in Rwanda, it could serve as a gateway to markets in the region. This region includes countries like Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and Burundi, which combine to form a single market of 1.38 million people and $82.1 billion GDP. And so that's where Rwanda is. Interestingly, it's the fastest economy in this region.
That's the fastest growing economy. Has that been just in the last couple of years, or has that been happening for quite a while?
Come again, sorry?
So it's the fastest growing economy in the region, or in the whole of Africa. Has that been going on for a while? And if so, what factors have been contributing?
Yes, interesting. You're good. Rwanda is the fastest growing economy within the region of East Africa, where we have Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and Burundi, like I said, mentioned earlier. And it became the fastest economy because of the reforms it has implemented over the last 10 years. It might interest you to know that Rwanda has remained the fastest growing economy for the past 3 years or so. And so it's not as if it just came out of the blues. And these reforms, like I told you, has helped to improve the business environment. And so that is what has led to Rwanda becoming the fastest growing economy in East Africa. Basically, reforms and implementation of these reforms.
And those reforms were helping to encourage private sector development rather than the state getting involved?
Yes, absolutely. That's the interesting thing about the reform in Rwanda. The reforms in Rwanda is actually geared towards empowering the private sector to grow the economy. Since 2000, Rwanda has developed a strong institutional framework for designing and implementing business regulation reforms. And these reforms have made Rwanda a destination for investors. Some of these reforms have been implemented in the area of contracts, getting electricity, registration of companies. For example, in Rwanda, for example, if you want to register a company, it will take you just 6 hours.
Wow.
You know, so this has improved the ease of doing business tremendously. Obviously, it has. I believe this is what has led it to become the fastest growing economy in that region. So leadership is very, very key, and that is why these reforms have really worked here. So just to give some statistics, since 2005, Rwanda has implemented 26 regulations.
And the World Bank has recognized this, I think, hasn't it, Samuel, in terms of its doing business report?
Absolutely. According to the 2013 World Bank Doing Business Report, Rwanda is the best performing country in the East African region, as well as the third easiest place to do business in sub-Saharan Africa. And of course, a high rank on the ease of doing business index means the regulatory environment is more conducive to the starting and operation of a local firm.
So are there still some obstacles for it to overcome, given the its sad history in terms of the tribal strife that it experienced almost 20 years ago? Is this recent strong economic growth helping overcome some of those wounds?
Sorry, what are you going to
do? Just to say, there are still some obstacles to its development, including its recent history of tribal conflict?
Okay, yes, that's true. Well, Rwanda's economy is largely dependent on agriculture, and that means it's a mono economy. What it means is that most of its GDP is as a result of that.
Right.
However, it is trying to transform into a knowledge-based and service-oriented economy. And in the next couple of years, we will be seeing loads of business travelers meeting in Rwanda. As a matter of fact, it's happening already. Rwanda is becoming a hub for businessmen, not just in East Africa, but across Africa. We have conferences being held in Rwanda on a regular basis. And this is a clean break from the story we used to hear in the past of war and strife. So it's true that the history of war, could deter investors from coming in. But like I did say earlier, the reforms implemented over the past couple of years has turned Rwanda around dramatically. And that's why it's a destination for business-minded people in Africa and across the world.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Samuel. I think that would maybe come as a surprise to some of our listeners exactly how big a transformation there's been. I really appreciate your bringing that to our attention, and we'll be speaking to you again soon about other aspects of Africa that make it an interesting place to invest. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Gavin. Have a great day.
And you too. Our thanks to our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, on the line from Lagos, Nigeria, with that look at Rwanda, which, as our first guest mentioned, has actually started a stock market in the last couple of years. Another illustration of what Samuel was talking about in terms of Rwanda becoming a more service-oriented economy and a pan-African destination. That wraps up today's edition of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. Please join me again next week for another round of reports from our global roster of contributors. I expect to talk to Paul DeSisto at M&R Capital Management in New York, look at some trends in frontier and emerging markets that may carry over into the new year. Our regular contributor, financial advisor and demographics researcher, Peter Merrick, will check in to talk about the demographics of Greece, where there may be a demographic time bomb in the making. Patricia Wee from Morningstar will explain the implications of the recent changes in the emerging and frontier market indices, including the move up from frontier market status to emerging market status for the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, and from the UAE, United Arab Emirates. Montasser Khalifi of the Quantum Investment Bank will look at the UAE's bid to host the World Expo in 2020 and what a successful application would mean for investors. We're also hoping to have a return visit from Kimberly S. Johnston, another contributor to our book, which will be where she'll be talking about private equity investment in Africa. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk and Role in an Investment Portfolio, now available in English-speaking markets around the world and through such good e-book stores as Amazon.com. We have Frontier Markets for Dummies, just completed and due to be out in March next year. And if you would like any information, please contact us at info@emergingfrontier.ca. Once again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks very much, and speak to you again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.